during the break, though, somebody asked a question, and that is, well, what really comes first, experience or presuppositions? Now, I said our definition of presupposition is what? Presuppositions are something that we take with us to our experience. So it sounds like presuppositions precede experience. But then the comment was, well, you know, where do we get our presuppositions from? Good question, right? Where do we get them from? Well, the answer to that is we get them from our experience. Well, what comes first? You just said presuppositions are prior to experience. Now, I'm not sure this is scratching all where he's itching, but here's one way to understand. Here's, put in that way, here's the answer. Prior, the word prior, like the word starting point, has different senses, right? A temporal sense and a logical or epistemological sense, right? The starting point of the race is in the back of the gym, right? That's a location, right? The starting point of fear of the Lord is knowledge. Well, that's an epistemological starting point, right? The starting point for the I mix my metaphors between a spatial and a temporal one, but the starting point of the race is 12 o'clock noon. Okay, different senses of the word. When we say that presuppositions are prior to our experience, we don't mean that, I don't mean that in a temporal sense, right? Because you think about child development. Babies are fascinating. You know, as a philosopher, it's kind of weird. You know, it's more like a subject rather than a baby, right? It's something to study. But you see them and they pick up all kinds of things and you learn a lot about, you know, philosophically I knew the nonsense of behaviorism, but as you see your child develop, you see just how utterly, appallingly stupid behaviorism is. Anyways, what you see is a baby experiencing all different things and developing very low-level beliefs about the world, and some of which will do what? Will become presuppositions. So in a temporal sense, the presuppositions come second. But in an epistemological, logical sense, they are what is prior, right? They're prior because once you have them, they fix the rest of your beliefs on the basis. Now, the big, you know, issues of life are, as Francis Schaeffer once taught, not that I like to quote Francis Schaeffer, but he had good things to say. By the way, most of his good things to say came right from Van Til, and the scandal of Schaeffer is that he never acknowledged it. He never acknowledged it. And the same thing with Edgar J. Carnell. He was also a student of Van Til, went departed from him, but never in print, never acknowledged it. So very poor scholarship, but even more than that, it's not very loyal to those mentors, the mentor that taught both of them. Anyway, Schaeffer said, our presuppositions, our worldviews are caught, right? Like you'd catch a disease. They're out there, right? So you catch postmodernism by being in this world, right? If you don't have your guard up. If you're not standing upon the Word of God, then you will be caught by the vain philosophies of this world. And so often the prevalent things that are going around, you'll catch. If you're raised in a non-Christian home, you're going to catch that, aren't you? You know, you may become a Christian later on, but you're not going to start off as a young person believing in Christianity because you don't. It's not part of your family. Even though at one level you know God and suppress that, yet you're not going to, it's not going to even have a chance to come out because you haven't heard about any of the particulars of Christianity. So in a prior, in one sense of the word prior, our experience comes first. Okay, we catch our worldviews. They're part of our environment. Van Til says, why do you ask, somebody asked him in his booklet rhetorically, or this pretend questioner, why do you believe in God? I believe in God because that's what I was raised, how I was raised. I was raised a Christian. That's why I'm a Christian. As a mature man, he'll say the same thing, but he'll also be able to answer that, and I also believe in God because of the impossibility of the contrary, because he is demonstrably true, and other reasons as well. Okay, so I hope that helps answer some question. Where do presuppositions come from? They Well, we catch them, we learn them by through experience, we're taught them. Okay, so don't think that presuppositions come before experience in every sense of the term. Okay, worldviews and presuppositions. We finished up worldviews. Worldviews are things that we have, we take with us to our experience. Networks of presuppositions, they answer the basic questions of life. Who has presuppositions? Everybody. Right, everybody has presuppositions. But that doesn't mean every presupposition, every worldview is a good worldview. There are differences, and we're going to be able to discern differences, and not all of them then can be true. Now, the next point here, and we'll get back to how we determine whether a worldview is true or not, but before we do, I want to bring out the issue of antithesis. Now, all of you are familiar with Hegel, right? All of you have read Phenomenologia des Geistes, and so you know what we're talking about here, so I just won't mention it. No, I think you need to know. Antithesis means what? Something that stands opposed to something else, right? Antithesis is something that is opposed to a thesis. And so Van Til liked to use this term quite a bit. And though it's not a biblical term, it's found all over Scripture. It's found all over Augustine's City of God. Antithesis. And what does it mean? It means that there is a standing apart, a difference between two different positions, two different people, whatever it is. An antithesis in this sense is a standing apart or an opposition of one worldview versus another worldview. The Christian worldview versus the non-Christian worldview. Now, everybody believes that there is some antithesis at some points, right? Otherwise, there'd be no difference between the Christian, the atheist, the Muslim, the Jew, whomever. We know there's differences. What presuppositionalism teaches, and what the Bible teaches, more importantly, is that the antithesis is extensive. The extent of the antithesis is everything. When we're talking about antithesis of worldviews, the differences between the Christian and non-Christian worldview, there is opposition between the Christian worldview and the non-Christian one at every single point. There's no agreement between the two. Now that sounds pretty radical, and so it's going to, of course, need explanation. But just let that sink in if you haven't heard that before. The Christian worldview is opposed by the non-Christian worldview at every single point. There is nothing that we share in common in terms of our philosophy of life with the unbeliever. They live in a city that worships man. They live in a city whose foundation is man. They live in a city that is living in a world that is the creation of their own imagination, okay, philosophically. We live in the real world. We live in a world in which we know God created. He created us. He has given us all things that we need. He has provided for our salvation. That's the worldview that we maintain. And if you take them apart, you will see that at no point will you find any agreement. Okay, there is an extreme antithesis between the two worldviews. Now, lots of things to say here, but first point is that I'm talking about two worldviews, where in fact, in one sense, there are many worldviews, right? But in another sense, there's really only two worldviews, right? There are Muslims and Buddhists and all kinds of religious believers. There are secularists, humanists, evolutionists, all kinds of those type of non-religious non-believers. So there's lots of different flavors out there. But they're all variations on a theme from Satan. Variations on one core principle, and that is we are God, we are the determiners of truth, man is the ultimate, right? Encapsulated by the old Greek philosopher, which is man is the measure of all things, right? Man is the measure of all things. That encapsulates anti-non-Christian philosophy. So there's two worldviews. The one that believes in the triune God of the Bible, that finds salvation in the Lord Jesus Christ, that sees salvation being worked out within the covenant community in the church, where Christ is going to come back and judge the quick and the dead, and those that deny all those things, right? And so the Mormons belong there. Do they believe in the Trinity? We say, well, they believe in God, yes, but not the same God, right? They don't believe in the God of the Bible. Well, they believe in a coming of Christ. They believe in a coming of somebody that they call Christ, but they don't believe in the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, because their Christ is not the same one as the biblical Christ. So if you go through even a Muslim's philosophy or theology, at every point, you're going to see that they are at odds with the Christian philosophy of life and the Christian worldview. Okay, so there's two philosophies, the Christian one and the non-Christian one, and these are opposed at every single point. Now, what's the obvious objection to this now? Yeah, it seems, or put it another way, it seems like we have agreement on things, don't we? How many of you live with near non-Christian neighbors? Yeah, we live in the world, right? Unless you move to places like Rivendell, where Christians move off in the woods and create a... And you know there's going to be big trouble there within 3 months. Not even 3 months. As soon as Christians start moving into one community. Not that I'm against it, but at this time in history, I'm not sure. You all live with non-Christian neighbors, right? Now, do you agree with them on anything? Can you have a talk about, what are you talking about? Gardening, sports, children, schools, politics? Can you talk to them about those things, and do you ever agree with them? Of course you do. Oh, well, this shows us that this notion of antithesis is a bit extreme. And this notion that Van Til taught, that it is the Christian worldview opposing the non-Christian worldview at every point, that is extreme. Because we get along with unbelievers. We agree with them on many different things. We can talk to them. Okay, now that's a common misunderstanding. Are we saying, when we say there's an antithesis between the Christian worldview and the non-Christian worldview, does that mean that Christians and non-Christians will never agree on anything? If that were the implication, then the notion of antithesis would be false. But is that indeed the implication? No, we need to make a distinction, right? The old medievalists always like to say distinguio. I distinguish between different things. One of the signs of a good thinker is the ability to make distinctions. We need to make a distinction between a worldview and a what? A human being. Human beings, you might want to write this in your notes, it's so profound. Human beings, some people are doing, I'm just kidding. Human beings are not worldviews. Isn't that profound? Human beings are not worldviews. What are we? Well, what is a worldview? It's a philosophical system. What is a human being? Well, you know, there's long and a short answer, but we are creatures made in God's image that share a common nature. And so human beings adhere to worldviews, but they do it in a way that is oftentimes inconsistent. They say they believe certain things, but we behave inconsistently. We always pick on unbelievers, but we should pick on ourselves, right? We always say that unbelievers don't live up to their worldview or live down to it, however you want to say it. We certainly don't live up to our worldview, do we? And we really believed everything we say we believe, then our lives would be very different. Very different. Every moment, every day, living in light of the things that we believe, being consistent throughout, not just in a few days, but weeks at a time, years at a time. If we lived that way, things would be a lot different, wouldn't they? In our own lives, in the lives around us, our family's lives, in the church's lives. We're not consistent, oftentimes. And human beings are often not consistent with what they profess. When it comes to worldviews, philosophies, right, theories, there is no agreement between the two. When it comes to practice, because the non-believer is inconsistent, then we do see that there is overlap. We can agree. No. We can agree that Corvettes are nicer cars than a Cobra. Right? We can agree with certain things with our neighbor because they are being inconsistent with their worldview. And they're being inconsistent because, and we'll have spend more time on this later, because it's impossible for them to be consistent with their worldview. Their worldview, what we read from Ephesians, is what? Their minds are darkened, right? They have a vain understanding. Okay, they are fools. The Bible calls unbelief folly. So they can't live that way because they would be going against everything in their experience. They can't live their worldview consistently. And therefore, the antithesis, position of the antithesis stands. We don't have any ground in common with the unbeliever when it comes to the things we believe. But in terms of the way we live our lives, we may find it there. That's because they're being inconsistent with the way they lead their lives. So there is this strong antithesis. Now, once again, Augustine taught this from a historical perspective, but it's all theological. Don't make a mistake. Don't read the City of God in a surface way. I mean, this is biblical spiritual principle he's talking about. These two principles of life, right? One of life, one of death. One that is for God, one that is for man. These are in a life and death struggle, and it's manifested in all areas of life. And the mistake that we make oftentimes is we think it's in these huge arenas. You know, and once in a while in history, there are those magnificent moments, aren't there? Where it's so clear that the city of God is clashing with the city of man. But it comes about every day in our lives, isn't it? Every day that we live, we are at war with the city of man. There's opposition there. We're fighting. And that's why Paul tells us to put on the full armor of God, because we're going into battle. Every time you finish brushing your teeth, and assuming you brush it first thing, if you brush it later on, then the illustration is not going to work. Or if you never brush your teeth, then it's really not going to work. As soon as you brush your teeth, get that armor on, because it's battle time. There is, maybe when you're sleeping, right, you have some respite. But every waking moment, your battle armor should be on because we're at war. Now turn to Genesis chapter 3, and we'll see where Augustine gets this notion from. Genesis chapter 3 is about the fall, of course. And every time I get near Genesis, I want to say a few things about understanding Genesis properly, but you've been taught so well on it that I know that you have the right understanding of Genesis 1, even though that's been an issue in the church of late. Genesis chapter 3 talks about what happened after man ate the forbidden fruit. And so he says to the woman, he curses the serpent, right? You know that it was man was the head of the woman, but the serpent went to woman. And we know that the serpent is the devil, but it's important that it's a serpent. A serpent is what? An animal. So we have the lower going to the a little bit higher, but not going to the covenant head. We have a complete perversion of things, don't we? Complete perversion of things and the temptation. Whereas if Adam had behaved himself properly, or the woman had, you wouldn't brought about order again. But we didn't have that. You know, it's no accident that the Satanists talk about drawing the circle backwards, right? Why did they do that? They pervert things. They want things their own way in a perverted way. And that's what we had in Genesis 2. In Genesis 3 we find the fall, and then God comes and pronounces his judgment and his curse. He curses the serpent first, and then he says to the woman, "And I will put enmity between thee," this is the serpent still, "and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." And he goes on to talk about the woman's curse. But to the serpent, he talks about this seed. The seed is something that is going to be at war. There's going to be the seed of the woman, which is, of course, what? Ultimately, the reference is to Jesus Christ. The seed of the woman against the seed of the serpent. This is the principles that are at war. And God says, I will put enmity between the two. The antithesis that we experience every day in our lives, and when it comes to philosophical systems, is divinely imposed. It's not an accident in history. God says that he places enmity there. God's purpose for our lives, therefore, after the fall, isn't to live a life of peace and tranquility. Now, we want outward peace so that we can lead a godly life, right? Paul tells us that in the New Testament. But God's purpose for the post-fall world is not a life of peace and tranquility. It is a life of warfare. I will put enmity between the two. And of course, that is between ultimately Jesus Christ and the evil one and sin. But by implication, of course, the followers of Christ and the followers of those in the flesh. There is a war that God puts into place from the very beginning. Okay, there is an antithesis between these two principles. And this goes back to an issue of neutrality again, too, doesn't it? There is no Switzerland in this war. There is no middle ground. You're either fighting on one side or you're fighting on the other side. So God imposes this antithesis, and the most foolish thing that we can think and desire is to live at peace with everybody in all senses of the word, right? I'm not talking about being good neighbors and having a good reputation with the unbelievers. I mean, just let's get along, nothing controversial. I was talking to somebody at a department store yesterday. I was being fit for something. And he was a nice man. He said, what I just want, you know, we're talking about different things. He said, what I just want is to make millions of dollars and to go off and live by myself in the woods with hundreds of acres around me. Right, so what is his goal in life? Right? To be away, live in peace and tranquility. You know, that's not our goal as Christians. Our goal as Christians is to have sharp swords, have a piece of metal on our arms, a shield that can withstand blows. We are to engage in the warfare and not draw away from it and not desire to draw away from it. Our lives are lives of battle. And if they're not living a life of battle, you're not leading a Christian life, because that's what it is. God imposes this antithesis, this principle of irreconcilable differences that's working its way in history, and this is the driver of history. This is what drives history. The history of the world is a conflict between these two forces. And we're part of it. You ever wanted to make history? You can make history every day. You're part of this historical battle. And in apologetics, we need to understand this, understand that their philosophy is vain, empty, deceptive. Okay, it's not according to Christ. There's nothing worthwhile in their philosophy. Nothing. There is, now, saying that, there needs to be another, not qualification, but put it in perspective. Does that mean that everything the unbeliever says about anything is wrong? No. That is because man is not a creator, and so he never has an original idea. None of us are original. And if we're not original, we have to get our ideas from somewhere. Even Satan does. Satan gets his ideas from God. Right? Now, he perverts them, but he gets his ideas from God. And so the unbeliever is like that. He gets his ideas from, ultimately, God himself. And that tells us that probably he's not going to get everything all wrong. I'm not a big fan of Herman Dooyeweerd, if you're familiar with him, but he said something that is, I think, right and profound. He said that the problem with man in his philosophies, he said there's a man makes an idol out of some aspect of God's truth. Right? So is there any truth to empiricism? Do we gain knowledge through experience? Of course we do, right? Of course we do. Is there truth in empiricism then? Sure. But what the empiricist does is he takes something that's true and turns it into an idol. Okay? The natural man always takes something that God has given him and perverts it. Okay, so they're not going to get it totally wrong, but they're going to forget everything else, and they're going to put it in an improper place because God's not at the center of it. So ultimately, it is useless, right? Even though they couldn't have thought it up without God, it still is useless and vain because it's not according to Christ. And so in this antithesis, we see those that think God's thoughts after him and those that don't, and their systems of philosophy are irreconcilable, and there's nothing we can scavenge or get out of their philosophy that's of any worth whatsoever. That's a radical position. Okay, that's a radical position that most Christian philosophers would scoff at. We can learn a lot from unbelievers. We can learn a lot from those that aren't Christians. There is truth to that in a sense, but not in terms of their philosophy ultimately. Their philosophy is vain and empty. We can't learn anything from them. Nothing. Doesn't mean that we can't learn from their inconsistent teachings that aren't consistent with their worldview. That's why we can read logic by non-Christian philosophers and gain something from it. Because they're not being consistent when they do it well with their worldview. Okay, this antithesis is imposed, and it's something that we are part of, and it has implications for our defense of the faith. Now, the next section is transcendental reasoning. The question that immediately arises after the coin drops about the antithesis and the worldviews, right? We have different worldviews. There's no agreement between them, no common ground when it comes to the philosophies themselves. If that's the case, then what's the point of apologetics? Haven't we just killed apologetics? There has to be some common ground, right? There's no common ground. I mean, think of going to a foreign country and not speaking the language. Well, you can communicate with them. You can make signs and point to things. So we can still communicate in a very rudimentary way because we do share something in common with the people in foreign countries. We share a common earth, right? We share a common humanity. So there is some common ground, and that is in our world that we inhabit, God's world, and we share basic humanity with them. So it's not at the point where we're going to say there's nothing we agree to with them. There's no commonality. There is commonality, but it's on God's ground, not their ground. Our common ground is not in philosophy. Our common ground is in God's world, God's existence, God's revelation, his natural revelation, and to a certain degree, a special revelation. That's what we have in common with the unbeliever. So we have a basis upon which to reach them. But how is that going to be helpful? Even if we say we had common ground, how is that going to be helpful? Because they have a different ultimate authority. They have a different worldview. And if they have different ultimate authorities than we do, then how are we going to have any type of argument that could have resolution? Because I'm going to approach things as a Christian saying, God says this. And my non-believing neighbor is going to say, I believe in science. Science says this. I say A, he says not A. Okay, well, I have the Bible, so I win the debate. Well, in a sense, that's true, right? But in a sense, that's really not telling the whole story. Because he could just come around and says, well, I have science on my side and a debate. Okay, we're at a standoff. We both have our authorities. We both stand upon different authorities, and we declare ourselves the victor. I won the debate. Why? Because my authority agrees with me. Yeah, but I don't accept your authority. Too bad for you, right? Too bad for you. Well, the problem with that is he can turn around and do the same thing, can't he? He can reason the same way. So we're at a standoff. If we have different ultimate authorities, if we have different worldviews, how are we ever going to resolve the debate that we have in a rational way? Right? I mean, I could take a gun out and shoot them and resolve it that way. But I mean, in a rational way, apologetics is the reasoned defense of the faith. So how do we resolve it? And the answer is there is no resolution, and I'll see you tomorrow. Well, there is an answer. And what's the answer? We're not going to resolve it in a straightforward, direct manner. Okay, what is a straightforward, direct manner? Appealing to evidence, right? Appealing to evidence. Looking at the facts, and saying the facts lead us to this conclusion, or the facts lead us to that conclusion. That's not going to get anywhere. Okay, because our opponent's going to interpret those same facts in a different way. He's going to view them in a different way. So it can't be a direct approach. So it's going to have to be, if it's not a direct approach, then it must be an indirect approach. Well, what does that mean? Well, we're not going to debate facts. We're going to debate what? Worldviews. We're going to have to debate worldviews. But how do you debate worldviews? By the way, Van Til, in a somewhat famous passage among his followers, says, it's okay to debate facts, right? We can debate facts, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to turn to the philosophy of facts. Now, there's nothing against evidences, but we're going to get to a point with the unbeliever that the evidences are not going to cause him to get off of his position. They're not going to drive him to the conclusions that we want him to be driven to. So we have to go back and debate and discuss the philosophy of fact. What makes something a fact? What philosophy interprets the world for us and is appropriate? So we need to do that, an indirect way, debating worldviews. Now, how do we debate worldviews? We have to debate them in terms of an indirect method, which includes two things. Right? And you're given as part of what we're looking at. One step is we offer an internal criticism of the other worldview. We go into the other worldview and evaluate it, not on the basis of our worldview, but on the basis of itself. Okay, that has been called an internal critique, which is opposed. Nobody uses this phrase, but I'll use it for pedagogical purposes, and that is an external critique. Okay, an external critique would be what? Your view is wrong because it goes against the Bible. Okay, that's just saying, here's my authority, you're wrong. Now again, there's nothing wrong with that at one level, but it's at one level it's also not a very interesting argument because they can return the favor. Your view is wrong because it goes against empiricism. What we want to do is offer an internal critique and show them it's not just on the basis of my authority that you're wrong, on your own terms. On your own terms, your worldview is can be proven to be false. Now, how do we do that? We had one answer here. We look for, say that again, inconsistencies, or logicians like the word contradictions, whatever, inconsistencies, contradictions in their worldview. So we go inside of it and we show that it is inconsistent, contradictory. Now, this entails we do what? We either know it beforehand, right? So if you're dealing with an evolutionist, you know some of the evolutionary theory beforehand, perhaps. Or if you don't know anything about it, then you do what? Ask questions, right? Well, tell me about it. Tell me about your view. And that one of the nice things about presuppositional apologetics is you don't have to talk that much, right? If you don't like to talk, like I don't really like to talk that much, you get to listen a lot. Somebody gets to tell, because they like talking about their own positions, right? People like talking about themselves. Well, I like that. I believe this. Blah, blah. Oh, really? Mm-hmm, okay. Sit there drinking your coffee. Huh? Go on. Just once in a while, ask them some prodding question to lead the discussion. And then once they have completed their exposition of their position, then what? Then you got them, right? Oh, okay. Well, you say this, but you said this over here, and that implies this, and that's contradictory. I'm going to give you, by the way, this is abstract now. I'm going to give you plenty of examples as we go on. But we're going to look for contradictions in their worldview. Contradiction is a proposition that's a conjunction that asserts one statement and denies the same statement. That's a contradiction. And what's the big deal about a little contradiction? So if somebody believes that Jesus is Lord and doesn't believe that Jesus is Lord, like a Muslim. Jesus is a prophet and Jesus is not a prophet. Say they believe contradiction. What's the big deal with that? Well, prima facie, it should be obvious, right? I mean, if your position is contradictory, that's simply what it means to have a false position. But it gets worse than that, though, because logically speaking, from a contradiction, anything and everything can be implied from it. Anything follows from it. So from the premises A and not A, it follows from it B, C, D, E, F, and then the negations of every one of these. I can write them all down. Now, this is abstract again, but I'm making it abstract because I want you to know that it doesn't matter what the content is here. Whatever the point in their worldview, that they have contradictions, whatever it is, they are committed formally to every other proposition. They're committed to, if you have a worldview that has a contradiction at any level, you're committed to the proposition that the moon is made of green cheese. It gets worse, because you're also committed to the proposition that the moon is not made of green cheese. Okay, you're committed to everything. And why is that? Some of you have had logic before. Tell me. Why is that? It has to do with our understanding of validity. A valid argument is one that whenever its premises are true, its conclusion is what? Also true. Well, here you have, if these are your, this is your premise, if you have A and not A as a part of your system, then it could always be used as a premise to an argument and as a sole premise. And if it's a premise to an argument, sole or not, then it follows that anything is valid can be validly inferred from it, as long as it's a proposition. Because whenever the premises are true, the conclusion is also true. Well, this is necessarily false, and so by our definition, no matter what this is, the conclusion, it's a valid argument. Whether it's true or false, it's a valid argument. So if you hold to this, you hold to everything. And if you believe everything, right, if you're committed to everything, then what? You're committed to nothing. Right? If you're committed to A and not A and B and not B, you're committed to nothing. It's utterly nonsensical. This is a devastating criticism. You can't get any more devastating than this. If you show that somebody has a contradiction in their worldview, then they're you show them that their worldview is false. So we're going to do this. We're going to look for contradictions in their worldviews, and we can also look for other things as well. What's another thing we can look for? How about arbitrariness? Arbitrariness, right? Making things up that is not organic with the whole system of thought. You give an illustration of something that's arbitrary and how to deal with it. Joseph Smith claims to be a prophet of God, right? You've all known enough about the Mormon story. By the way, I think Christians take Mormonism, we study it far too much. I found a 6-minute clip on YouTube that's a cartoon. I don't know if any of you have seen it before, but it's a 6-minute clip on Mormonism. It is the best thing I've ever seen on Mormonism. Because all it does is in a cartoon form, and it doesn't really do it in a satirical, mocking way. It just, you know, shows them, points out to people, gives people what Mormons believe. And it is a hoot. And it's not intended. It's just, here it is, here it is, here it is. And by the time you're finished with it, nobody would ever need to say anything more than that on Mormonism. So if you have a Mormon friend, find it on YouTube, send them a link, and then you've done it. They might be offended, though, but it's good for teaching Christians about Mormons. Okay, so the Mormon says that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God. Okay, well, we can go and do the internal critique and look at the contradictions, right? That's no problem. But we can also look at it from a basis, a point of view of arbitrariness. And so try this. Do the Mormon, I haven't seen the Mormons in my neck of the woods lately, but do you still get Mormons around here? Some of you, okay, well, try this. When they tell, you know, you have to steer the question, the discussion towards why they believe it, right? Why they believe it, and it's going to come to Joseph Smith. The whole Mormon religion is based upon this one man. I mean, he's so megalomaniacal that he told his wife that she has to accept another wife on the pain of hell. I mean, just somebody with a huge ego, and for some reason charismatic enough to have people follow him. Okay, so you got this guy that claims to be a prophet. He speaks for God. Okay, now you can of course go through the biblical doctrines, a biblical teaching on it, and look at Joseph Smith's prophecy and things like that. Here's an easier way to do it. When they go into their spiel about Joseph Smith, all you need to say is, with a straight face, Joseph Smith is not a prophet of God. And they're going to, of course, want to know, well, why would you say that, friend? You know, with their permigrin smile, the twinkling of their tooth. Why do you say that, friend? You know, that's these little kids, you know, these young kids that have you're supposed to call them elder, and they're 18 years old. Well, Elder Bob, the reason is, I am a prophet of God, and God has just told me this very minute that Joseph Smith is a false prophet and is burning in hell forever. Now, stay with a straight face and continue with it, right? What is your point going to be? And what point do you hope that you want the shock? Because oftentimes the shock leads them to an epiphany, right? Some realization that something really is bizarre about this. The point of it is, if Joseph Smith can claim to be a prophet, why can't I, right? It makes life so much easier. Love, I want chicken cacciatore for dinner. On the pain of hell, fix it, right? It makes life whole. Go to Nordstrom. God told me to give me that suit for free. You might end up in jail, but you know, if you can con a few people, it makes life easier. Present it to him like that. And the point is what? Arbitrariness. Okay, if your position is arbitrary and anybody can make the claim, then it's meaningless. It's worthless. If your philosophy is based on arbitrary positions, then it's worthless. Okay, now this criticism isn't quite as devastating as the contradiction, but it does show that non-Christian positions offer no reason to believe them. Right? If you're going to present somebody with a case for something, you want to get somebody to believe something, to buy something, whatever, you have to have a pitch. And if you have no reason for somebody to buy something, why should they ever buy it from you? Right? Hey, I'd like to sell you some shoes. Why? What's good about your shoes? I don't know. Do they have a guarantee? No. I don't know. I mean, are they for athletics or dress? I don't know. I mean, why would you possibly buy something from somebody like that? And it's worse with the false religions because they're not only not giving you any reason, they're giving you reason not to. Just completely arbitrary. And then finally, the criticism that we're going to level against unbelievers and their worldviews is that their worldviews are not rich enough to provide the preconditions of human experience. Now, that's part of this right here. If there's contradictions in their system or arbitrariness, then they're not, on another ground, rich enough. Because something that's false cannot give you something that's true. But in another sense, non-believers have worldviews that do not provide the preconditions for human experience. They're not rich enough. Right? The naturalist says that we can have science from naturalism. Oh, you can you? Well, how do you derive science from naturalism? And science meaning the kind of, think of it as the self-conscious application of empiricist epistemology. So how can you get that from naturalism? Well, naturalists teach that all things are natural, all processes are naturalistic. That includes what type of processes? Thought processes, right? Now, if our thoughts are basically reducible to natural processes, then why do we believe they're rational? In fact, a natural process is something that, by definition, cannot be rational because it's a different category. Things that happen, machines, say, or electronic circuits, we don't call them rational, except in a very metaphorical sense. They just have these mechanical, electronic, natural reasons for what they do. There's nothing rational about it. And so if our beliefs and our rationality is based upon naturalistic principles, then why should we believe anything our minds produce or the beliefs that they turn out? Right? There's no reason for it. See, naturalism cannot account for science. That's the irony of ironies, isn't it? The naturalists like to beat us over the head. You know, you Christians believe in young earth. You don't believe in evolution. You know, science teaches us all these things. I'll spend more time on this later, but baloney. Science teaches us none of those things because the naturalist cannot even account for science. Science is not on his side. Science is as alien to him as the Gospels of Jesus Christ. He can't have science because his worldview can make no sense of science. And so when we deal with unbelievers, we're going to have to use an indirect reasoning. Because there's an antithesis, because of our presuppositions and our different worldviews, because there's no neutrality, we're going to have to reason with him in a way that's different than those who do not hold these biblical truths. We realize that our method cannot be the same. Our arguments cannot be the same. So we're going to have to argue in an indirect way, showing them that their view is impossible. Their view cannot make sense of the world. Their view is contradictory and arbitrary. And so we're going to offer an internal critique. Now, I think it's time for a break. Now, when we come back, we're going to answer the question, is that enough? Is it enough to show that our unbeliever, the proponent of an unbelieving worldview, has a faulty worldview? Is that enough?